competitive process. The East Side Loop project is infinitely more complex. We're going across the river, we're going across an active railroad, and there's a lot of utility work to be doing, so it's a really appropriate project to do this.
The other point that I'd like to underscore and air out is that as we wait longer than we want for federal government response to our request for $75 million under the Small Starts program, and that we don't know when and if they might have a response to that, the work that we're doing here helps keep the project on time. The inflationary costs to this project are about $500,000 a month. So, worst case scenario, if the federal government does not act on this until into next year, the work that is done as part of this portion of the project helps us keep the overall timeline more intact. And again, this comes back to council in the form of an actual selected bidder. This is simply authorizing that the bids go out. So council, this is not authorizing that we actually sign up a contractor. This just authorizes the bids to go out. So council will have the opportunity, given what we know of, in the next couple of months to say yes or no to actually signing on the contractor, correct?
Yes.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have anybody signed up to testify, Sue?
I did not have a sheet out for this one.
Anybody here who wishes to testify on this item? Okay. Please call the roll.
Adams.
Aye.
Fish.
I appreciate Sam's your comments. It answered some questions that I had. So, aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Okay, the ordinance passes, and we're now to item 1391.
Vacate Southeast 44th Avenue between Southeast Umatilla Street and Southeast Harney Street, subject to certain conditions and reservations.
President, Mayor-elect. For the record, my name is Dee Walker. I'm with the Office of Transportation, Right-of-Way Acquisition, and I'm here to present a street vacation request. And actually, the presentation of the Carter Award is the perfect segue into this because it's another watershed program. So as you can see, BES, who is the petitioner, owns three out of the four abutting properties. So this vacation is proposed to consolidate property for construction of the Arrow Creek and Wetlands Habitat Restoration Project, which will improve fish and wildlife habitat. And it helps to implement the Johnson Creek Watershed Council's Watershed Action Plan, along with BES's Johnson Creek Restoration Plan. There have been no objections. Notices have been sent out to all the bureaus and agencies. And
so we're vacating this for BES?
Yes, they're the petitioner. BES. And actually, yes. Allie Young with BES is here if you have any questions for her.
Definitely is well-timed with the Carter Award. So
that's what I thought.
Yeah. Any questions? Okay. Thanks, Dee. Does anybody wishes to testify? Or
no one signed up.
Anybody here wish to testify? Okay, this
first
passes.
Reading.
First reading. This is a first reading, so it will pass to second reading.
Thanks for your work.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. 1392.
Accept city engineer report on designing for truck movements and other large vehicles in Portland.
So with the, come on up, the work of the city's first freight master plan, we have sought to be really clear to the community and clear to ourselves what are freight routes, what are not freight routes. As the third most trade-dependent economy, regional economy in the United States per capita, transportation for us is a key part of our job creation efforts, and freight is a key part of that. Today we're continuing on the track of perfecting our efforts around the movement of freight. And in this particular case, there are design guidelines. And they've been worked through not only the Freight Advisory Committee, where we're going to hear from folks today, but they've also been worked through with neighborhoods. So this will guide our efforts in our ongoing work to improve and maintain the system. as poorly funded as it is.
Bob. Okay, it works. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Adams and council members, for the opportunity to present the Designing for Truck Movements and Other Large Vehicles in Portland for your consideration. Again, my name is Bob Hillier. I'm the Freight Planning Coordinator with the Portland Office of Transportation. To my left with me here today is Bob Russell, President of the Oregon Trucking Association and also a member of the Portland Freight Committee. And what I'd like to do today, just too loud?
No.
Okay. What I'd like to do today is provide a brief presentation and provide an overview of the policy basis for these guidelines, describe how they were developed, and really focus on the key elements that are contained in the guidelines. But first, so why should we care about freight and truck and freight movement in Portland in the first place? Well, Portland is a gateway city and has historically been a center of trade and commerce in the Northwest. Today, Portland is the fourth largest freight hub on the West Coast, due in part to the convergence of key highways, railroads, and marine routes. 11% of our region's workforce is employed in the transportation sectors. This is the third highest concentration of employment in these industries in the nation. We're only behind Atlanta and Miami, so transportation plays a big role in our overall economy. A wide variety of goods are moved throughout the Portland region over a transportation network that includes highways, heavy rail, marine, river barge, pipeline, and air cargo. However, about 70% of all freight tonnage either passing through our region or being delivered to local businesses moves by truck. So how does the city address freight transportation issues? Well, this is done through our Transportation System Plan, also known as our TSP. And the TSP serves as a 20-year guide for implementing the city's transportation policies, projects, activities, for all modes of transportation. The TSP also establishes a street classification system for freight and all other modes as well. Under the TSP policy umbrella are the modal master plans, which provide detailed guide for mode-specific policies, infrastructure needs, and implementing actions. As you can see in this chart, the bicycle and pedestrian master plans were adopted about 10 years ago by the City Council in 1996 and 1998, respectively. And more recently, the Portland Freight Master Plan was adopted by City Council in May of 2006. And developing street design guidelines for trucks is one of the key implementing actions that were called for in the Freight Master Plan. This map shows the freight classification system adopted as part of the Freight Master Plan. I'm not sure how it shows up on your screens. Basically, this system is based on a hierarchy of freight streets and related land use activities. All streets within the city of Portland have a freight classification. They also have a classification for all the other transportation modes as well. And this map shows the city's freight districts, which are highlighted in the red hatching on the screen to the top of the screen. These areas include Rivergate, Airport Industrial Districts, which are located along the Columbia Corridor in North Portland, and also the Northwest Industrial District, which is located along the US 30 Corridor in Northwest Portland. Now, streets in these areas are primarily designed to serve heavy freight activities and provide access to port terminals, rail yards, warehousing and manufacturing facilities, and also to provide direct access to the interstate highway network. Example of these facilities include North Green Drive, Columbia Boulevard, Northwest Front Avenue, and North Going Street. At the other end of the street hierarchy are the truck access streets, which are represented by the blue lines in this map. And these streets are primarily designed to serve local delivery of goods to businesses located along the city's Main Street areas. An example of these areas include Southeast Division, Southeast Hawthorne, Northeast Broadway Boulevard, and Northeast Fremont. Now, the street design guidelines are based on these adopted street classifications. Okay, this chart shows how the street classifications correspond to the two primary categories of freight movements, essentially heavy freight or industrial serving, and the commercial delivery of goods and services. As you can see, the TSP classifications are shown on the left side of the chart, and the black dots represent the primary activities or categories of freight movements. As you can see, the regional truckways, the priority truck streets, and the freight district streets, they're primarily designed to serve heavy freight activities, again, serving the major transportation terminals, warehousing activities. Examples are Interstate 5, Columbia Boulevard, Northwest Front Avenue. And whereas the major truck streets and truck access streets, a little further down the hierarchy, they're designed primarily to serve goods delivery to local businesses along our city's main street areas. Examples of major truck streets would include MLK, Northeast Saney Boulevard, and Southeast Powell. Now, as I previously mentioned, all streets have a freight classification, and the last category here on this chart are the local service truck streets, which are primarily our residential streets, and they provide they have to provide truck access for things such as FedEx, UPS vehicles, solid waste haulers, an occasional moving van, and also emergency access vehicles as well. So that pretty much just summarizes the policy basis for designing the street design guidelines. I just want to briefly go over the process for developing the guidelines. Work initiated on design guidelines during the development of the Freight Master Plan by the project consultant team, and a working draft was prepared. Earlier this year, we provided more work on the final draft, and we formed two technical review teams to review and refine this draft guideline. One technical review team was made up of PDOT staff, essentially management and senior-level staff from the various PDOT divisions. Essentially, these are the folks that actually design the road. And the other technical review team was made up of members of the Portland Freight Committee. Bob Russell, my left, was part of that team. And essentially, these are made up of members and citizens that provide commercial delivery and freight moving services within the city. So this is a group that actually uses the roadway facilities. And after a final working draft was prepared, the guidelines were presented to the city's three modal advisory committees. In March, I went out to the bicycle and pedestrian advisory committees and met with them and gave them an overview of the guidelines. We also presented to the full Portland Freight Committee. And then in April, I met with Scott Bricker of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. We went over the design guidelines as well. And he was also involved with developing the Freight Master Plan process and was interested in the guidelines. And just recently, about a month ago, I presented to the Regional Freight Technical Advisory Committee. Essentially, this is a metro committee made up of freight planners like myself from all over the metro region and the various counties. And they had a chance to look at the guidelines as well. So we feel we had a pretty thorough involvement and overview process for these guidelines. We wanted to get a lot of input, again, from various people that would be impacted by this document, both the designers and the users of this document. So basically now what I'd like to do is just focus on what are the key elements that make up the design guidelines. And essentially what these guidelines primarily do is compile all existing federal, state, and local guidance and summarize it into one document. Essentially this provides a quick reference document for engineers and planners. Currently, what designers use right now is a vast array of different guidance, such as federal AASHTO guidelines for geometric design, state and federal freight policies, and also the transportation system plan. So essentially what this does is kind of put all the guidance under kind of one roof, so to speak. Another key aspect of the got visitors here. That's okay. Another key aspect of the guidelines is that we recommend street dimensions, which is based on the city's adopted land use, transportation policies, and street classification system. And the guidelines also provide a comprehensive checklist of engineering and development review considerations to assist roadway designers, both at the design table and in the field. This came out of the development of the design guidelines from some of our engineering and design staff. And basically, they wanted to see just a real brief checklist, so to speak, of a list of a whole array of items that they need to they would like to consider and should consider during the design of local streets. And examples of that would be when they go out in the field, looking at what some of the dominant truck sizes are as they move through a corridor, how they're turning, look for tire tracks on curbs and sidewalks to see if there's adequate or inadequate length, width in the right-of-way. Another aspect of the guidelines, they also include design vehicle characteristics for all truck types, from a what we call a single unit 30-foot local delivery truck all the way to a 53-foot tractor-trailer rig, also known as the WB67. Again, selecting a design vehicle is context sensitive, which meaning it really means it depends on the various urban environment we're planning for. When we're planning for roadway improvements in an area like Rivergate in a freight district, the predominant vehicle is going to be a large tractor trailer rig like a WB67. So we will design a road to accommodate that type of vehicle because that's often the predominant vehicle in that area.
Do you mind if I ask a question on that? One thing I've noticed is there are increasing number of tractor trailers, particularly on the arterials, that have multiple trailers attached, and they seem awfully long. And I've noticed that when they switch lanes, it's a greater challenge. And when they exit and make turns, they sometimes have to essentially get people on lanes to sort of pull over so that they can make the turn. Is there a limit on the length of those multiple tractor trailer hookups that is allowed under federal law?
I'm going to turn this over to Bob Russell.
Mr. President, members of the commission, my name is Bob Russell, president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. Yes, there is a limit. There's been a freeze on truck sizes and weights since 1991. At that time, all of the states had to submit their current regulations to the federal government, and it was adopted into rule by the Federal Highway Administration. The current limit for trucks, and we're talking trucks that operate every day, is 105 feet. What you're seeing mostly on arterials are doubles, what we refer to as doubles with two trailers. The reason that we use those often in the urban environment is because they are articulated and they actually turn better than a single trailer would turn. The single trailer, the standard box that Bob was talking about, the 53-foot trailer, actually has the worst turning movements of the types of vehicles that we traditionally utilize.
Are they limited to a double or can there be a triple?
There can be triples. Triples are authorized in Oregon as they are in a number of states. However, their usage is confined to certain highways, primarily the interstates, although the terminals of the trucking companies that use them will not be right on the interstate. So there's what's called reasonable access, so that the trucking company will make up the set of triples and be able to operate on city streets or whatever to get to the interstate. And
I don't mean to get us off track, but
sure.
Is there any evidence that what you call doubles or triples provide a greater hazard to other cars or greater risk of accident than single tractor trailers?
Actually, triple trailers are the safest combination that operate in the state of Oregon, and primarily because there are some additional requirements on those particular vehicles than on your regular trucks. Drivers have to be experienced. There's a whole bunch of things that go into that. But the safety record of triples is exemplary. It's outstanding.
Thank you.
I'd just like to make one other point about selecting a design vehicle. Again, it depends on the different urban environment we're looking at. As I mentioned before, up in an area like Rivergate, we're going to be looking at a large tractor trailer rig. We get closer into town along our centers and main streets. Often what we use as a design vehicle is a standard 40-foot city bus because these are usually major transit corridors. And typically, we could accommodate a city bus in our centers and main streets. We could also accommodate a lot of the delivery vehicles to serve the local businesses located along these areas as well. And finally, one thing we also included in design guidelines, we identified a number of case studies that the city staff has recently looked at and resolved some design problems. One case study that I wanted to include in here was the Pearl District Safeway, which was recently approved. And basically what we wanted to do is show how trucks could accommodate a grocery store in a very dense urban environment and really kind of identify what some of those access and circulation needs are for these businesses and some of the challenges they pose to both designers and truck drivers. So that basically concludes my presentation and overview of the design guidelines. The recommendations here today is for the City Council to accept these guidelines for inclusion in the design standards for public streets, which are part of the city's transportation policies and administrative rules. I can answer any questions you might have, what I just presented. But first, I'd like to have Bob Russell on my left speak on behalf of the Portland Freight Committee.
Again, Mr. President, members of the council, my name is Bob Russell, president of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'm here to testify in support of the street guidelines. One of our principal goals as the Portland Freight Committee has been to incorporate freight considerations in sort of the everyday workings of PDOT and the city. And we think this is a huge step forward where designers will actually be considering truck movements as they design projects around the city. We also think that it's an excellent balance between the competing modes, particularly in the urban environment. You've got lots of modes competing for the same space. We think that the street design guidelines balance those competing interests very well. We also think that it will allow us to continue to efficiently serve the businesses that are located in the city. But perhaps more importantly, we think that the street design guidelines will have a significant impact on safety. Because if truck movements are designed for in the first place, then we won't have the conflicts when we're using the streets. So I would urge your support, and I would like to thank the good staff at PDOT, Bob, John Gillum that's sitting in the back, and of course Commissioner Adams, who's the sponsor of the Portland Freight Committee and is in charge of PDOT. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Based on your experience around the state and sort of networking nationally, where would you say in terms of planning for freight and sort of the making it work in an urban environment, where would you say Portland sort of ranks in terms of being innovative, progressive versus other cities?
My opinion is that Portland is doing an outstanding job. Many of my colleagues in other states are very envious that in our largest city that we have a freight committee and that we talk about freight issues and that we're doing things like adopting the street design guidelines to accommodate trucks. So Portland's doing an outstanding job. Thank you, Commissioner.
That was just a bald-faced effort.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
But I do want to use it as a springboard to...
Of course, we're number one.
Yeah, we're number one.
Best in the world.
Best in the world. I want to use that, though, as an opportunity to thank Bob for all our great staff work, because I might be the commissioner in charge, but you're the person that staffs this effort and staffs the Freight Committee. So I want to thank you for your great innovation, your great staff work.
Welcome. Is there anybody signed up to testify on this?
And I did not have a sign up for this.
Anybody wish to testify? Okay, so this is a report. Do I need a motion to accept that, or do we just call the roll? Need a motion to accept
motion?
The report.
Right.
Okay. Need a motion to accept the report.
Motion to accept the report.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Sue, please call the roll.
Adams.
And also thanks to Shoshana Oppenheim in my office for her work on transportation. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Salzman?
Good work.
Aye.
That brings us now to item 1394. Yes.
Right. Ben, do we need to read 1393 in the record? That's the one we're referring back. I'll just read that real quick.
Okay.
Quickly. 1393, authorize an intergovernmental agreement with the Housing Authority of Portland and the Portland Development Commission for development and operation of the Resource Access Center development on Block U in North Old Town Chinatown. And that has been referred back to okay. Commissioner Fish's office.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, 1394.
Authorize a ground lease agreement with Portland Hope Meadows for international housing, intergenerational housing at 4221 North Willis Boulevard.
This is the second reading. Please call the roll.
Adams?
Well, I voted against this award of this or consideration of Portland Hope Meadows for receiving this piece of property. I had concerns about the process or lack of process that was used to choose the Hope Meadows for use on this property, but I absolutely am very supportive of what they do and their mission. And it's no reflection on their organization. Council made a decision, and I'm going to vote to move forward with that council decision. And I want to thank you for your commitment to design the project so that it blends in with the neighborhood and has some neighborhood benefit as well. I want to encourage you to keep going with fundraising, both on the capital and operating side, and I recognize that we need to take this step in order for you to be taken seriously by a lot of prospective funding organizations and foundations. I like the fact that what we're considering today gives you a window to do that, and it also requires you to come up with some operating support as well. So I like the way that this has been written in terms of expectations, and ask that you continue to work with the neighborhood on all issues as you have in past year. So with all of that good work recently, I vote aye.
Fish.
Well, I want to begin by acknowledging and thanking all the people who took time to testify on this issue. I, as the newest commissioner, listened carefully to the testimony. I reviewed all the written materials that were furnished to me, including correspondence. I had a chance to meet with a number of concerned citizens, and I asked my bureau to take a good hard look at the budget pro forma for the development that we were furnished. Since I was not part of any prior deliberations on this issue, I have, of course, taken a fresh look at the application and have come to it with an open mind. Tony Hobson of SEI, who testified last week, I think provided a useful framework for evaluating this application. He described it as a three-part process of what, how, and who. So I'm going to steal that framework in terms of my assessment of this opportunity. Let's start with the what. Hope Meadows is based on a model that has been successful nationally. It is an intergenerational community designed to match loving, caring adults with foster children. I'm particularly impressed with the commitment to not only a safe environment for kids, but to very high levels of high school graduation rates. How? I have reviewed the budget pro forma with my bureau and with others, and clearly, as with many developments of this kind, the financing depends on a variety of sources, including tax credits, foundation money, and private fundraising. An $11 million budget for a development of this kind would be challenging in any environment. In the current economic climate, I think we recognize that Hope Meadows faces significant challenges going forward. It is for this reason that it is especially important to me to look at the who. Who is part of this team moving forward? In this area, I believe that the team that Hope Meadows has assembled is as good as it gets in the affordable housing field. I've had extensive experience with Carlton Hart Architects, most recently with the Jerome Sears site in Southwest Portland. They have a record and they are highly skilled at developing attractive, green, affordable housing, and equally important from my point of view, to working collaboratively with neighbors to develop these kinds of projects. Walsh Construction. Walsh Construction has a distinguished reputation for delivering affordable housing on time and on budget, most recently at the Humboldt Gardens development. They are highly skilled at helping people make challenging projects pencil out. The board of Hope Meadows. I have to say I'm impressed with the composition of the board and its allies. I think it's the right blend of community leaders and people who are skilled in fundraising, and folks who are hard-headed. They have already demonstrated success in attracting foundation money, and I'm not prepared to bet against this board. Based on the foregoing, I believe that Hope Meadows has made a good faith effort, to address the issues which my colleagues raised last year before I joined this body, and has presented to us a proposal which has a reasonable chance of success. But there are additional safeguards and protections built into this proposal which tip the balance even further for me. The draft lease agreement with the city has a number of deadlines, and benchmarks in it, and failure to meet these deadlines and benchmarks would result in the return of the property to the city. Hope Meadows has agreed to enter into a good neighbor agreement with the Portsmouth Neighborhood Association and has in fact been meeting regularly with concerned neighbors as they have been moving forward. The Board of Hope Meadows, confirmed by their architect, has agreed to include the community in all phases of the planning process. OMF, on behalf of the city, will be overseeing the project to make sure that it is meeting its lease obligations and providing timely reports to this council. And finally, Hope Meadows will be required to seek and obtain a conditional use permit, which will provide additional protections and opportunity to be heard for the neighborhood. I'd like to congratulate Commissioner Saltzman and, in particular, Shannon Callahan, who I don't see, but hopefully is
listening. Right over here.
I was going to say she might be listening on the TV.
She's way over there out of
Shannon is hiding, and that's she is reluctant typically to take credit for her good work, but she's done a terrific job. And the rest of the folks who have worked on this. And I'd also like to acknowledge and thank the leadership of the Portsmouth Neighborhood Association for their willingness to engage this issue and for their testimony last week before this council, which I think we all felt was among the best presentations we've ever had from a neighborhood association, and clearly was offered in the spirit of trying to work a reconciliation, not to place unnecessary barriers. This is not a perfect project, and there are clear risks going forward. However, on balance, I believe moving forward with this project is in the best interest of the city, and I proudly vote aye.
Leonard.
I, too, did not support this when it first came before council a couple of years back, and primarily because I didn't believe that the neighborhood had been given the opportunity to be involved in the decision. In fact, I think a review of my record in the past 6 years would confirm that in hearing after hearing on issues that affect neighborhoods, whether they're land use hearings or public policy discussions such as New Hope Meadows, I am inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to neighbors and neighborhoods. And the amount that I defer to neighborhoods increases as the sophistication of the other side increases. So the more money and highly sophisticated attorneys that show up on behalf of a developer or anybody who has an idea, the more I'm inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to those lay folks that come here just to make their case. So I hope in that context that those in North Portland understand that the hearing last time eliminated any doubt that I had. And in fact, not to contradict Commissioner Fish, because I think in essence I agree with his observations, but I was disappointed in some of the presentations made here, and specifically some of the comments made by those who live in the North Portland neighborhood. I attempted to give them an opportunity to specifically identify which parts of the plan that they were particularly concerned with in my attempt to try to resolve that. And I drew the conclusion that no matter what was done, they were essentially and irrevocably opposed to the concept of New Hope Meadows in the neighborhood. I was disappointed at the lack of acknowledgement of the goal of this proposal to help some of the most challenged and fragile children in our society. And those are kids that are in foster care. I have some familiarity with that system, both as a former legislator and as a one-time foster parent. It is a trying circumstance to be kind. And I hope that some of what I heard here last week is the last that neighborhood hears that. And I certainly hope that the children that end up being there are not subjected to those kinds of comments because I will go from being even-handed to having some amount of ire to those that would direct such unseemly comments to those kids who are doing nothing more but trying to survive in a world that hasn't treated them very well. So having said that, I did appreciate the presentation by New Hope Meadows. I did appreciate the focus on exactly what the mission was, not allowing themselves to get distracted by some of the comments and observations that were made by others. And for those reasons, I did something I don't rarely do. I changed my position with respect to the placement of this in that neighborhood, and I congratulate New Hope Meadows and Commissioner Saltzman and wish you all well. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I want to start off by thanking my colleagues. I also know that if Mayor Potter were here, he would be absolutely voting in favor of this too. There are really few, if any, innovations in helping foster kids find adoptive families. Hope Meadows, Portland Hope Meadows, is one of those innovations. More than 3 years ago, I was introduced to the Hope Meadows model for an intergenerational community to help our city's foster children by a very driven and dedicated woman, Rhonda Meadows, who was here last week. Thank you, Rhonda, for sharing your vision and your tenacity in making Portland Hope Meadows a reality. I'm very pleased with the progress that has been made over the last few years. Portland Hope Meadows has put together a wonderful board, hired an extremely capable executive director, contracted with a top-notch developer and architect, and raised millions of dollars in the private sector. I would also like to thank everyone who testified last week, both those in favor and those who raised concerns. One of the concerns we heard about was about how the design of the project would integrate with the surrounding neighborhood. Since that hearing, my staff, AKA Shannon Callahan, has spoken to the chair of the Portsmouth Neighborhood Association, Greg Wilhelm, and to Dorinda Schubert, the executive director of Portland Hope Meadows, and has confirmed that it is our expectation that the neighborhood will be involved at every step in the design of the project. And I'm pleased to note that Portland Hope Meadows has committed to ensuring that this will happen and is creating a design advisory team with members of the Neighborhood Association. Portland Hope Meadows will be a model community, a community that will bring together three generations to share their lives. Hope Meadows will offer a caring, supportive family environment, not just to the former foster children who will reside there, but to their parents and their surrogate grandparents. The children of Hope Meadows will have a bright future, a future they might not otherwise have without Hope Meadows. They will have a permanent, supporting, loving family to help support them through high school, college, and beyond. This truly is an innovation. So before I cast my vote, I also want to recognize Shannon Callahan of my office. She has done an outstanding job. Her passion for this project is reflected in the caliber of her work and her commitment to going over every line item of the lease and hammering everything out and bringing this project to where it is today, which is on the verge of happening. I'm pleased to vote aye. The ordinance passes unanimously.
She's hiding around the corner there.
Thank you, Shannon. We now move to item 1395.
Accept 2007 annual report by the Independent Police Review Division.
Good morning, members of council. My name is Mary Beth Baptista, and I believe I've met each one of you and Commissioner Leonard when he returns. I'm the director of IPR, Independent Police Review. I'd like to take this opportunity before we move on to the annual report to introduce our new assistant director.
Hi, I'm Constantine Severe.
Constantine Severe started as our assistant director yesterday, so I told him to bring his tie and come here and have a conversation with you all today. He earned his degree at Vanderbilt University, his JD degree, and he has spent the last 3 years as a Metropolitan Public Defender, and I am really pleased that he's going to bring in a fresh perspective for us, and I think we're going to be a good fit.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So on to business. I'm here today to introduce the report and for your acceptance of the 2007 annual report. We released this publicly on September 17th. 2008. At that point, I did provide each of your offices, you and your chief of staff, a copy of that report. My apologies in the few week delay in getting here in front of you all. The reason being is that I'm a member and a participant of the Performance Review Board across the street with Portland Police. They also meet on Wednesday, and so I was previously committed to those important meetings, which is why this is my first opportunity to be here. But I'm sure that gave us all extra time to read the 61-page report that I trust that you are as encouraged as I am by the findings that are in that report. I wanted to highlight some of the important and positive trends that are happening in Portland police that are described in the annual report. First, police shootings and use of force complaints. Police shootings are down 48%. 48% fewer shootings in the past 5 years compared to the previous six. This reduction coincided with a 5+% decline in contacts between police and citizens, widespread introduction of disabling weapons like tasers and beanbag guns. I have the graph there in front of you, and I just wanted to have a quick note on why 1997 was chosen for that. As you all know, IPR wasn't in existence in 1997, but the reason that we chose that start date for the graph was that in 2003, PARC, the Police Assessment Resource Center, conducted a review of 32 officer shootings and two in-custody deaths that occurred in Portland between January 1, 1997, and June 30, 2000. PARC picked that number for that report because they determined that was as far back as reliable data was available for a meaningful analysis. So that's why we have used that as our start date. Excessive force complaints are also down 37% since its peak in 2004. The number of force complaints per 1,000 citizen police contacts has declined 34%. The year 2002 was chosen as a start date because that's when IPR began and began to collect that important data. We also reported a very positive trend in accountability in our 2007 report. Accountability is up in the Portland Police Bureau. Police commanders are sustaining more allegations against their officers. In 2006 and 2007, commanders sustained one or more allegations in 30% of the disciplinary actions, investigations, compared to 15% of the investigations in the preceding 4 years. An average of 30 officers per year received discipline or command counseling in 2006 and 2007, as compared to 2005, the first year that data was tracked, where 17 officers received discipline or command counseling. We also reported evidence that officers are correcting their own behavior, that there is a culture of accountability that is gaining momentum. We saw a significant drop in individual officers receiving multiple complaints. So that is also a positive trend. Also in 2007, a significant amount of work was done in developing a new policy on the use of non-lethal force. The policy emphasizes de-escalation and resolution of confrontations with less force than the maximum allowed by law. It provides significant new guidance for officers and supervisors and requires that operational units regularly review unit force practices and individual officers' performances in confrontations. So based on that work that was done primarily in 2007, in early 2008, March of 2008, the Portland Police did adopt this new force policy. So we're encouraged by the work that was done that received that result. And generally, this report really signals to me that there is a real positive momentum that is happening with IPR as well as Portland Police. We have a high level of confidence in this data, and the data is clearly good news for the Portland Police and the citizens of Portland. The trends that we have identified in this report are solid and document real change and opportunities for continued progress. I'm very encouraged by what this successful collaboration of individuals can do at IPR, the Citizen Review Committee, and the Portland Police. I'd actually like to, for my shop, I'd like to extend a special thanks to the folks that really made this report happen. Derek Ranke, our senior management analyst, he's responsible for crunching every number on that 61-page report, and Pete Sanrock, the other assistant director, contributed a significant amount of text in that report. And Carol Kirshner, who is our office assistant, helped with the layout and the release and every part of that report. And without them, we couldn't bring this good news to you. And in addition, I want to make a comment on the release of this report because I think that also shows some real positive momentum that's happening. As we all know, in our line of work, very, very rarely does good news actually get reported. But in this case, the good news and the positive trends that we reported got significant news coverage. We were on the front page of the Metro section of the Oregonian. We were covered by two major network news on both the noon, 5, 6, and 11 o'clock news. And OPB Radio covered it in their evening and morning drive times. So to me, that really signals that the public is listening and that we have a real opportunity here to improve the communication with the public. And I am very excited for IPR. I'm very excited to be the director of this outstanding organization, and I look forward to increasing our level of service to the community, improve our relationship with council and the mayor-elect, and continue our positive working relationship with the Bureau.
Thank you. Any questions?
I might have questions after the testimony.
Great, thank you.
So I did have a couple of questions. I have read the report, and I agree with your observations here. This is very good work that's been done by both you and the Police Bureau, and I certainly want to acknowledge that. But and I have a long history of service here in the city, and I think it's fair to have different standards for different employees based on their responsibilities. And so I have one standard, for an example, at the Water Bureau for employees that work there, and quite frankly, a different standard for the 911 operators that I'm responsible for. And I think that's fair. Mm-hmm. There is no group of people that should that have a higher standard, in my view, of conduct and performance than police officers. And the reason, of course, is not only can they deny one of their civil liberties or property, but take their life. So for that reason, I think it's important to focus on especially the good stuff that you've done, but also to talk about a couple areas that you observed of concern that is not, actually, frankly, the first time I've heard these areas of concern. And they are found on page 20 of your report. And I'll just quote, you say, despite excellent overall progress on findings, IPR remains concerned that the Bureau has sustained only one citizen allegation of excessive non-lethal force in the past 6 years. Do you care to talk about that and give me your sense of why that might be and if that is an indication of some other problem that we need to do some work on?
You know, we pointed that out because we share your concern. So
I actually wasn't saying I was concerned. I was reading it back to you and giving you an opportunity to tell. I don't know if I'm concerned yet or not based on what you tell me.
We're concerned.
Okay.
We think that this is an area that we need to look at, and we need to take a hard look at it and understand why that is happening.
Do you have any opinions or observations now?
Well, the one opinion I do have is since I've been here at the end of May, right, and so we have to assess that I'm new to the scene. So I'm looking at these investigations. And I got to tell you, I've reviewed a significant number of IAD investigations and had conversations with the assistant director, Pete Sandrock, about them. And they are improving with every investigation. They are stepping up to the plate. They are accepting the challenge. They're asking the hard questions. I don't know if that's always been the case. But I can tell you, I know that Assistant Director Sandrock, who has significant more experience in reviewing those just by his time being here, has noticed a real trend in a increased level of investigation and quality of investigation. So it's my hope that with these more thorough investigations, we'll see this number change. But this is an area of concern. That's why we highlighted it, and we're going to watch it.
So do you hope that it changes because in your work you've concluded that some of these cases probably deserve some level of discipline, and then you have observed that the Bureau has not pursued that, and is that why you're concerned? Or do you simply think that the numbers should be higher and you're not sure why?
You know, in my view, I'm looking at that there are these allegations that are coming forward and these investigations that have been done. And there are times where we don't necessarily agree.
With the finding of the Bureau?
That's right.
Okay. Gary?
Gary Blackmore, City Auditor. If I could add a little more history to this. We raised this issue a number of years ago in our annual report, and one of the big steps I think we're seeing was the new force policy is going to change, I think, the level of expectation of the officers, and it's going to be there's, I think, easier ability to clearly identify misconduct and to follow through on it. So my sense is we'll see some changes, not only in terms of good investigations, but clear expectations of officers.
I appreciate that. And then the second one, again, is not one that I've become aware of by reading your report, but it's a common observation, and I'll quote that too. And it says, PPB's review process for completed IAD investigations is slow. Timeliness in this stage of case handling continues to be of concern. The review board process began to show slight improvements in timeliness, but commanders and managers made far fewer recommendations within 30 days in 2007. So maybe you could expand on that.
The process is slow. The process is slow from our shop as well. We all understand the experience of having, you know, more work and less people to do it. I think that's a concern. I think it's very important for accountability that we speak to the officers and to the citizens as quickly as possible. That's an area that we agree with you needs improvement. It's not something that we're ignoring.
Again, I'm asking you to tell me why you think it needs improvements. I don't want you to misread my question. I'm wanting to hear what it is you observe so I can decide if it isn't appropriate or not. Let me just kind of clarify the issue that I've heard. The perspective I've heard this from is mostly from the officer perspective, who is in limbo, sometimes 2 years, waiting to hear what ends up happening to that officer as a result of an investigation. There has to be some reason for that happening.
Well, there's two things to look at. One, a lot of these, if we're talking about force review board and performance review board investigations.
Talking about whatever you were talking about. You said on page 20, under PPB review and discipline process, I just read to you your comment. So whatever you were talking about.
Right. Well, I heard you say something about performance review. I thought I heard you say something about performance review and all of that.
I said you said the review board process began to show slight improvements in timeliness, but commanders and managers made far fewer recommendations within 30 days in 2007. So I'm just asking you to tell me what that means.
Well, there's two things to look at. One, when we do the performance review and force review board, where IAD investigations go to that level, we're also somewhat tied to the civil litigation process. And so there are delays that are completely out of our hands. And I know that's when the officers are you know, really expressing their concern about not being able to, you know, move on, and things take 2 years, and it's not fair to them, but there's things that we just cannot control.
Okay, I'm not asking you about you. I'm asking you about your observation about commanders and managers and the observation that your report makes that they made far fewer recommendations within 30 days. So I'm trying to figure out why that, if you've decided or concluded why that is.
I think one of the reasons is that there's a lot of change going on in the organization. There's a real need for leadership and coordination at that level. Plus, more attention on all of these cases draws the management away from their day-to-day change and day-to-day duties of managing the organization. I don't often say this, but I think, frankly, the management team the chief has is putting in as many hours as they can to do as much as they can, but ultimately trying to schedule these kinds of meetings to talk about disciplinary matters, as well as trying to handle all the day-to-day crises of a police agency, makes it difficult for that to happen quickly. Spreading that workload out over one more manager might be a way to accelerate
that. So an observation you might make to help improve that is to hire somebody that might be more focused on resolving these disciplinary issues.
I would check with the chief on that because, I mean, my sense is she may say, well, you know, I've got 14 things I've got to do and three people to do them, and I might, with one more person,
I didn't see this as a criticism of the assistant chiefs. It was of the commanders at the precinct level.
There's only so many hours in the day, and trying to get them all together in a room to do the command level review is very difficult.
Other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sure we have some people signed up to testify. You could call the first three.
We have two people signed up, Dan Handelman and Barbara Fredericks.
Okay. Welcome.
So we'll give you, if you could just please give us your name, and you each have 3 minutes, and we'll start with you, ma'am.
I begin. My name is, good morning, commissioners. My name is Barbara Fredericks. I'm here representing the League of Women Voters of Portland. First, we would like to thank the IPR staff for completing another annual report and for its commitment to publish future reports in a timely manner. As Professor Luna Feuerbaugh explained in her performance review of the IPR, one of the fundamental principles underlying civilian review boards is the people's right to know the people's business. Comprehensive reports are an excellent tool for accomplishing that goal. There are several issues in the report we would like to highlight today. First, according to the report, 60% of the cases referred to Internal Affairs were classified as service complaints, a 21% increase over 2006. These are considered minor rule infractions, and complainants do not have a right of appeal. Given their increasing number, an option for a complainant requested review or reconsideration, we suggest, should be explored. Secondly, the use of force complaints have decreased over the past years, along with complaints overall. We share Commissioner Leonard's view that of a total of 594 citizen allegations of excessive use of force in the past 6 years, only one was sustained. Our position is it's possible that citizens feel it's futile to file a complaint. Similarly, given the limitations of the complaint survey, the complainant survey, we do not know if the decreasing number of complaints overall can be attributed to better policing or to a lack of trust in the IPR. Third, the report points out the shortcomings of the complainant survey with its low response rate and lack of follow-up. It's essential that we understand how the system is working from the perspective of those who use it. When resources permit, the League recommends contracting with an outside expert, perhaps to develop a survey instrument that would result in a more accurate assessment of the system. Fourth, there are several excellent suggestions in the report of items needing citizen review committee auditing or study. Considering the substantial workload these volunteers already carry, the League continues to believe council should consider increasing the committee size. And finally, in a few cases, the highlighted comments in the report, that is in the executive summary, are not consistent with a more detailed examination of the data. It would take some time for me to explain those. We've included them in our written testimony that we've submitted. Once again, we appreciate the IPR's work on the report and are pleased that it is being presented at a city council meeting. Next time, we hope that a bit more notice will be given. Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question. I'd like to ask you to give me at least one example of what it is that gave us in writing so the public
sure.
can hear that. And if you need to give two, that's fine as well.
Sure. The executive summary correctly states that the number of force complaints per 1,000 police contacts has declined 34% since 2004. That statement, however, doesn't tell the whole story. Table 2.4, which is at page 9 of the report, called Citizen-Initiated Complaint Allegations Reported by Category, shows that use of force allegations as a percentage of total allegations have remained at a consistent 8% since 2004. So if you look at the data from that perspective, there has been no change in use of force allegations since 2004.
Maybe I missed that. What's the reason for the distinction in what the executive summary says and what you've concluded?
The executive summary says there's been a 34% decline in police in the number of force complaints per 1,000 police contacts since 2004. And if you look, you see the numbers on the bottom. But if you look at the chart more carefully, you'll see that the rate of complaints is still the same for since 2000. It's just 8% every year.
So how is it that they concluded in the executive summary there's a 34% decline?
I don't know.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
So I didn't miss it.
Right. That's our point. It's not clear.
I see.
A second example is the executive summary accurately points out that the complainant's satisfaction in the outcome of their case is increased by more than 11%. And dissatisfaction decreased by 18% in 2007. On the other hand, Going back to the report again at page 57, figure 5.10 shows that 32% of complainants are satisfied, but 50% are dissatisfied, and 17.9% neither are satisfied nor dissatisfied. So in other words, a large proportion